Well, we're in the book of Judges, chapter 14, and to tell or to not tell, the verb hagib is used 14 times in the chapter. Whenever I read through, I start reading through, sometimes Sunday evening or Monday morning, I start reading through, and I just keep looking for words or themes that are repeated, and normally I find the pattern and what's really going on in the passage through the repetition of words. Well, as I read through, I just couldn't help but see to tell or to not tell, or they knew or they didn't know, is used multiple different times throughout the passage. I thought, well, that's what it's got to be all about, isn't it? Telling or not telling, knowing or not knowing. And I just couldn't really see it. It sent me off on a rabbit trail, really. But God's purposes were secret, weren't they, to Samson's parents? They couldn't understand what was going on. They were scratching their head, and God's purposes were secret to them. The slaying of the lion, that was secret to them as well, and everybody else, and the riddle, and it all goes on. But the four things that I've got this evening is begins with Yahweh's providence. We begin with Yahweh's providence. So the wife of Manoah, the mother of Samson, she bore a son, and she called his name Samson, we see at the end of chapter 13. So there you go. It was prophesied and it was promised, and it's all happening according to plan, just as was said. And the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. Oh, isn't that wonderful? We had to say that the child grew and the Lord blessed him. Just a few short little words, but wouldn't it be lovely for all of us as parents to be able to say the children are growing and the Lord is blessing them. Well, it goes on, it gets even better, doesn't it, in verse 25. Not only is the Lord blessing them in a general sense, but and the Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him, we are told. So it really is really, really good news. Just as planned, just as expected. This is no ad hoc, is it, or band-aid affair. This is no piece of divine crisis management. There is a problem, but God is dealing with the problem and raising up a judge before he is even conceived. This is no last-minute plan B in operation. God is very much in control of the entire situation, and he doesn't just grab somebody out of nowhere in somewhat surprise and fits him into the situation not being very equipped or able to deal with it. He's dealing with this one before he is even conceived. The judge is called, he is chosen, he is prepared before conception. And we will stop at some point, and we will see the multiple different ways in which Samson is a type of Christ. And we can see, obviously not in his sinfulness and in his weakness and in his failures and other things, but in many different ways. These are pictures for us as we look through the New Testament into the Old. We are going to see the life and the person and the work of Christ at some point more clearly. Anyway, he is called and he is chosen and he is being equipped to become the judge. But as soon as you turn and open up chapter 14, everything changes, doesn't it? You look at chapter 13, you think this is absolutely fantastic. You can almost kind of rub your hands together and go, right, the Philistines, they don't stand a chance. There's going to be a massacre and there's going to be a right royal turning back to the Lord straight away, isn't there? And well, the Lord has used Gideon and a number of others in the past, but this one really is going to smash the enemy, and we're going to have a great work of God very quickly, right at the very beginning. But although chapter 13 finishes so positively, chapter 14 opens up and you think, oh dear, what is going wrong? Now Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah, the daughters of the Philistines. So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, I've seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore get her for me as a wife. Then his father and mother said to him, is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among all my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? But, it says, and Samson said to his father, he wouldn't reason with him. Wouldn't submit to him, get her for me, he commands almost, for she pleases me well. I'm sure that they're very upset, aren't they, with a very strong-willed son at this point. It seemed to start so wonderfully and well at the beginning, but I am sure, and you can tell with the words and the choice of words, he's determined to get her, though, for his wife. And I would imagine that the parents are somewhat shattered after the amazing beginning of chapter 13. I mean, how many of us have had the angel of the Lord come and tell us that after many years of not being able to conceive and barrenness, that, well, you're going to have a child and he's going to be filled with the Spirit of God and he is going to begin to judge Israel and deal with all of the problems of the Philistines. And then for him to come back and then for him to consume an offering and then to disappear up in the smoke miraculously, you kind of think, goodness me, this really is going to be a special child. We all think that our children are very, very special and better than everybody else's children in many, many ways. But they really did have cause to say, you know what, my child really is very special. But try to imagine them now by this point. He's now more than an adolescent and he's roaming around and he's gone down and he's seen amongst the Philistines a woman who has caught his eye and he's not reasoning. He's not going to be distracted from all of this. I want her and I'm going to get her and you're going to go and get her for me, Dad. You can almost imagine the tone of his voice in verse 3. Isn't there a woman amongst all the thousands of women of the Israelites that you could take for your wife? This uncircumcised Philistine. It's almost like this uncircumcised heathen, this unclean, devil-worshipping, idol-loving enemy. And these are the enemies, aren't they? They're not just some kind of kind neighbors who worship another god. Not only are they idolaters, not only are they people who sacrifice their children in the worship of God, these are the people that keep coming and raiding and oppressing. These are the enemy, aren't they? And you must be thinking, well, I can imagine poor Manoah scratching his head going, God, what on earth are you doing? This is not what I had in mind at all after chapter 13 and the events of chapter 13. Try to imagine Manoah, his father, at this point in his language. Try to imagine Samson's state and condition at this point, because in verse 3, well, get her for me, for she pleases me well. Now, what is the book of Judges all about? What are we told a couple of times in the book of Judges? What is it that we've got to grasp if we're to understand anything about the book of Judges? Is that men did what they wanted and what pleased them in those days. And he just seems to be like the backslidden masses, doesn't he, in Israel? What pleases him? What he wants, what he likes, not what the Lord wants, not what God is leading and guiding, but what pleases the eye and what pleases me and what I want, that's what I'm going to have. He seems to be like the typical man in the book of Judges. But notice in verse 4, although it opens up and it's pretty bleak and dark, and you think, poor Manoah and his wife, what a kick in the teeth after chapter 13. But his father and his mother, they did not know that it was of the Lord. But that he, and the he there is the Lord, isn't it? That he, the Lord, was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines. For at that time, the Philistines had dominion over Israel. Samson is doing wrong. It is not right what Samson is doing. It is expressly told them that they are not to marry heathens, but they are to marry within their own people. It was right for Manoah and his wife to plead with Samson and tell him that no, this isn't right and this isn't good, and to resist Samson's wishes as best that they could. But against all of their preconceptions and against all of the scratching of heads and the shaking of their heads and everything else, the Lord is at the bottom of this. God cannot do evil. He is not the author of evil. He doesn't tempt, neither can he be tempted, the scriptures say. Yet he is pleased to decree evil, to work through evil, and cause the things that tempt us so very often to work for our good and for his glory.
Now that is a big one to take on board, isn't it? That's hard, isn't it? You see, the Buddhists are trying to work it out, the Hindus are trying to work it out, the Greek philosophers were trying to work it out, the Muslims, they're all trying to work it out, the mystery of the world, why are things as they are, and well, they've got their yin and their yang, they're black and white, and they're good and they're bad, they're positives and they're negatives, and this, that and the other, and they just can't work out how on earth could God be all good, perfect and holy, and yet, well, be absolutely in control of all of the suffering and the evil and the problems and the pain that there is on earth. Well, the Bible opens it up and it explains it all and it lays it out all clearly so that all of the mysteries of the universe can be grasped in quite simple and clear languages. He is working, isn't he? He is working through all of this. Samson is imperfect. Samson is sinful. Samson is stubborn. Samson seems to be ruled by his heart and not by his head that had been instructed in the ways of the Lord. It reminds us, doesn't it, that in the midst of all of our stubbornness, the stubbornness of our children, in the midst of all of our own sinfulness and the sinfulness of our children, in the midst of our own stupidity and the stupidity of our children, very often, God is always at work. What a glory to be able to just see verse 4. And Manoah and his wife, they can't see it. And Samson's doing his own thing. But God has not been removed from the throne. God has not lost control of the situation at all. God is very much on the throne where he always has and he always will be. And he says to us that all things work together for good towards those who love him and called according to his purposes. Now, I know that's not easy. I'm not standing here this evening going, I've got it all down and this is just easy stuff. And you poor lot, well, you're just left struggling a little bit with life. Not at all. Not at all. Life can often be a struggle, can't it? And often, sometimes it's our children, isn't it, that can hurt us the most. They're the apple of our eye. They're the things that we love most down here on earth. And their stupidity and their stubbornness and their sinfulness can cut our hearts into pieces often. Well, here's a passage that reminds us that all things are working for good. Manoah couldn't see it. His wife couldn't see it. And they're shaking their head and they're scratching their heads and they're crying out, how could you possibly go and marry this pagan heathen and this, that and everything else? But as we look into the passage, we can step back this evening. We need to step back in our lives, don't we? We don't need to be anxious about anything. We don't need to be worried about anything. We don't need to panic. Panicking, anxiety and worry really is the opposite of faith, isn't it? And this is a passage that reminds us that when we begin to be anxious and worry and panic, as we all do, we need to remind ourselves of who God is and what God is like and just keep telling ourselves these things again and again and again. We see the providence of God. It's something that we see again and again throughout the book in various different ways, but it's something that is very forcefully and powerfully seen here as the writer of Judges wants us to see that this evening. As we sang that God works, he works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform, and he just keeps turning around. William Cooper, who suffered such great depression and discouragement and this, that and the other, he could just, sometimes he felt that he was just holding on by a thread. Other times he didn't feel that he was holding on at all. But it was the Lord that was holding on to him. All of these troubles and difficulties, the storms of life, they were going to turn out to be a blessing to others, to himself, and ultimately in the life to come, they will cause glory to God and, well, more rewards for him if we hold on and live by faith. Yahweh's providence, very clearly seen, something we really, really need to grasp and understand if we're to walk with the Lord in any good, fit, strong way.
Second thing we see then is Yahweh's power. Sorry, we've had providence. Now we walk into power in verse 5 then. They're still scratching their heads and wondering, goodness me, what's going on with all of this? But Samson, he goes back down to Timnah with his father and mother and came to the vineyards of Timnah. Now, to his surprise, a young lion came roaring against him, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat, though he had nothing in his hand. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. And here we have Yahweh's power. We're going to see that a few times as we look through the life of Samson. But it just reminds us, doesn't it, that, well, God is very powerful and he is enabled. He can and he often does pour out that power into our lives. These verses aren't there just to provide us with material for a good parable at the wedding. He could have used multiple different parables. Although the book of Proverbs had not yet been written, maybe, there were other parables in the Word of God that had already been used. Or God could have miraculously revealed any other parable to him without this event. But he wanted Samson to really feel and experience and know the power of God upon his life for the work that he would do later on. And we see again and again in chapter 14 and then 15 and then in chapter 16 and multiple different times, the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him and empowers him to do quite miraculous things. This seems to be the first time anyway recorded that Samson has been filled with the Spirit of God. He had been blessed and he had been stirred in some way by the Spirit in his childhood and young life. But now something quite miraculous happens and he is well given strength over a young lion here, and he just rips the lion apart like you would a goat, we are told. It would have been a great confidence booster, wouldn't it? Like David later on, as he's standing before Goliath. And well, where are you going to get your confidence from? If God had never worked in your life before, and this was the first time that you were going to trust that God was really going to enable and strengthen you, that's a big thing, isn't it? But David says, no, I've stood against the lion. I've stood against the bear. God help me with the lion. God help me with the bear. This Goliath is no trouble at all. And so later on, when Samson needs to stand against multiple men and the Philistines, this would have been a great confidence booster that God has done it and he is able to do it again. Well, we see this in the Gospels, don't we? Jesus does something quite miraculous and powerful, and then the disciples have got very, very little faith. And the editor sometimes puts in, they just didn't understand. He fed 5,000, but then they're panicking on the ship, aren't they, in the midst of the storm or the boat there. And Mark, the editor, just writes in, because they just didn't get it with the feeding of the 5,000. Well, it reminds us of the reality and the need in our own lives for the Spirit of God to empower us. We're told again and again, aren't we, in the book of Acts, the Spirit of God, when he comes upon us, he will empower us to be witnesses. Paul tells us that the kingdom of God is not just in word only, but in power. He tells us, doesn't he, in 2 Timothy, that as we read at the beginning of the meeting, we've not received a spirit of fear, but of power, of love, and of self-discipline. And that is what we are going to need if we're to live out the Christian life. You see, Christians are to be loving, joyful, peaceful, patient, kind, gentle, self-controlled people, aren't they? Christians are to be like Jesus. Well, my friends, if you've made any effort at all, if you know anything about him and you've made any effort at all to be like him, you'll know it's just impossible. It's just start raving lunacy to try and become like Jesus without the power of God in your life. It will utterly depress you. It will just kill you to try and be like Jesus without the power of God in your life. Or what about putting to death the deeds of the flesh? We're told in Romans, aren't we, that if by the Spirit we put to death the deeds of the flesh, we shall really live. So how can we be really spiritual? How can we overcome the spirit of this age and the carnality and the worldliness of this age? Well, Paul tells us the only way you're going to do it is, well, by putting to death the deeds of the flesh through the Spirit. Or what about witnessing? It doesn't matter how open or extrovert you are going to find yourselves in situations where you are going to be ashamed, or it is going to be a whole lot easier to keep your mouth shut rather than open when you know you have an opportunity to speak for the Lord. Doesn't matter how extrovert, it doesn't matter how loud you are, it doesn't matter what personality you have, we can't be those bold witnesses unless the Spirit of God comes upon our lives. What about praying? Now, maybe at first, when we first become a Christian, we find praying easy, and we love to pray, and we love to talk with the Lord, possibly, because we don't know it, but the Lord is filling us with His Spirit. But as the months and the years go on, to really spend any consistent time in prayer during the week, to really be able to come to prayer meetings consecutively and consistently, to be able to come to the prayer meeting for revival once a quarter on a Saturday and just really pray for 2 hours straight, that's not easy. It's impossible to do in the flesh. To really lay hold of God, to really grasp what is it that we should be praying about, and to consistently go on praying, can't be done in the power of the flesh. It can't be. You'll just give up. You'll become so discouraged by it that you'll just give up. But we're told again and again that all of these things are not done in the power of the flesh or in our own ability or in our own strength, but to love. And to rejoice, to be peaceful, to be patient, to be gentle, to be kind, to be self-controlled, to overcome the flesh and worldliness and all of these things, to be bold witnesses, to pray, even to hope when there seems to be no hope, we're told, is a work of the power of the Spirit of God in our lives. And the wonderful thing is that we don't have some localized deity who has somewhat done something mystical and magical so that we've grasped hold of him and we've built an idol of him in the middle of our town. It's not that we worship some man-made, futile God that we've invented. It's the God of creation, isn't it, that we worship. The God who said, let there be light, or light be, and light was. The God who is eternal and uncreated, who sovereignly chose to create rather than not create, it is His power that is available to us. The power that governs and sustains and upholds the entire universe. And the more we look through our telescopes and the more that the scientists teach us about the universe we live in, we're just overwhelmed, aren't we? The scientists looked at the Bible where it says that there are as many stars up there as there are grains of sand on the earth. And they laughed and they ridiculed and they thought, what a load of nonsense and rubbish. Well, now we know that there are as many stars up there as grains of sand there are on the earth. It's just mind-boggling to try and conceive of a God that can just speak into existence all of these things and name them one by one. Or what about the incarnation? The eternal God becomes a man so that he is in every sense 100% man, but yet remaining to be God. The hypostatic union, if you like, of those two natures. That is the power that is available to us as believers. The power of his miracles as he raised the dead and fed 5,000. The power to remain sinless. The more we read in the Bible about what sin is, the more we grasp what sin is, the more we grasp of the law of God and the holiness of God, the more utterly and outstanding it is that the Bible would begin to tell us that there was one man who was sinless.
Now, if you know nothing about God, nothing about holiness, nothing about the word sin whatsoever, and you have a very dull conscience, maybe if I told you this evening that there was a man who was sinless, you'd shrug your shoulders and go, no big shakes. But you read the law of God, and you read about the holiness of God, and you read about everything the Bible says about sin, and then hear that there was a man who was sinless, and you'll say that is utterly, utterly, completely miraculous and amazing. It's that power, isn't it? Power that created, power that upholds, power that brought Christ into the world, the power that enabled him to remain sinless all of his life, the power that enabled him to endure the wrath of God against all of the sin of his people. Keeps talking about a cup, doesn't he? Jesus keeps going on and on about a cup. It's repeated again and again. When there's repetition in the Bible, it's because he really wants us to grasp it and to listen up. He's always going on about this cup that he has to drink. But it's the cup of God's wrath, isn't it? His judgment against sin, his anger against sin, his judgment and the punishment that sin deserves comes upon him. I've said it before, but it's the best way for me to understand it. It's a cup that no angel would begin to even be able to look in or look at or lift up or wouldn't even begin to dream about taking a sip of. And yet Jesus not only looks, not only lifts, not only smells, not only tastes, but is enabled by divine power to drink down to the very dregs, so that there is no eternal punishment for the millions that will enter into heaven. Well, what about the resurrection? It's the center thing, isn't it, of all of the book of Acts. That there he is, he's dead. He's dead as dead. He's not going to be resuscitated. There is nothing and no one that can do anything. His heart didn't just stop or murmur for a few seconds and then through some electric shock he got going again. We're talking about dead as dead can be. We're talking about 3 days completely dead. The soul has departed from the body and he is in every sense dead as the Bible describes it. But he doesn't just get resurrected from the dead. He doesn't just become resuscitated from the dead. He doesn't just come alive again to die again like Lazarus, but he conquers death and he brings life and immortality to light so that he can stand there and look people in the eyes and say, I am the resurrection and the life, and anyone who believes in me shall never die. See, that's the power of God, isn't it, throughout the scriptures. It's the power that we must seek. The Bible tells us again and again, we're to pray for this, seek this, hunger for this and long for this in our lives. We're not going to be able to love our wives as Christ loves the church, are we? Unless we have the power of God. Wives are not going to be able to submit to their husbands in all things except for sin, obviously, unless they are empowered quite royally with the Spirit of God. We're not going to be able to do these things. The Christian life is a miraculous life. You can't reason your way into it. You can't reason your way through it. You can't get some checkbook and checklist and this, that and the other and with some kind of psychological program or anything else live out the Christian life. It is impossible. It is impossible to live out like Jesus lived and obey the commandments of God on our own. Well, Samson is empowered and filled with the Spirit of God. And, well, it would be good, wouldn't it, if each and every one of us this evening who are believers say, yep, I need to pray more for the power of God to be upon my life. Third point then is man's weakness. Although that's very encouraging and challenging in many ways, you got from verse 10, you kind of hinted at it at the very beginning, but now from verse 10, so his father went down to the woman and Samson gave a feast there for the young men, and you've got the riddle and the telling of the riddle and the like, haven't you? And well, in the telling of the riddle there, we see his weakness. The shadow is really beginning to fall over Samson's story now, and we have hints of things that are to come.
The Philistines are sweating, aren't they, lest they lose the bet. They're not only going to lose 30 items of clothing, but they are going to lose their pride and their reputations. Only Samson knows at this point about the lion, the bees and the honey. And so in today's currency, the bet is on. It's for 30 sets of underwear and 30 wedding suits. I would imagine probably in the region of about 20, 30 weeks' wages. Something like, very valuable bet, isn't it? If they win, they're all going to get a nice new outfit for their next Dagon festival, their idol god. If Samson wins, he's going to get himself a great big wardrobe, pagan style, isn't he? But no matter what, everybody's reputation is going to be lost or won. Come on then, let's have the riddle, they keep saying. We can't work it out. And they hound her and they hound her, don't they? Until finally they say to her, we're going to burn you. We're going to burn down your father's house. I hope you've got life and household insurance because we're coming to get you unless you tell us. The 3 days turns to 7 days, doesn't it? And you can imagine how edgy and irritable, frustrated and humiliated they are until finally there are death threats. Comes to the seventh night, she puts on the waterworks, her trump card, and Samson can't deal with it anymore, and he caves in. He can destroy a lion, we're told later on. He can overcome 30 men, even 1,000 men, we're told later on. He can break ropes, new ropes. He can break out of the loom when his hair is woven into it. He can even push the temple pillars and bring a whole temple down. But he can't resist the tears of a woman. He is overcome by this nagging wife. He tells her, she tells them, the Philistines have got their trump card. They come out, don't they, before the sun goes down. And well, we have humorously, don't we, if you have not ploughed with my heifer, you would have not solved my riddle. And it begins there, the weakness of Samson. He sees this woman, takes pleasure, doesn't he, in this woman, and he wants the woman. And then she nags at him, and well, he just can't resist. He can't seem to stand up. He can't resist, can he, the pull of women. And it goes on into chapter 15 with Delilah and others as well. And although he was a man that was filled with the Spirit of God, although he was a great judge, although he goes down in the book of Hebrews as being a great man of faith, he had his weakness. It may not have been worldliness. He didn't want to get rich. He wasn't a man that longed for vast amounts of money and the things of this world. Maybe it wasn't pride. He didn't want a huge reputation. He didn't want his name on all of the front pages of the newspaper and everything else. But he had his weakness, the flesh. And we need to understand how the devil works. And although he is very, very powerful and he is very, very subtle, he is very, very predictable. If you look at him right in the Garden of Eden, Eve, she sees that the fruit is good to eat. It appeals to her flesh. That is going to taste really nicely and give me a nice sensation. It looked good to the eyes, didn't it? And it would make her wise as God. Well, there you have it, don't you? It looked good. I want to own it. I will compromise and I will sin to get the things of the world. It tastes good. I will compromise and I will sin to gratify my bodily appetites and flesh. And it will make me wise like God. I will compromise and sin for the sake of my reputation and my ego. The devil does exactly the same with Jesus. Doesn't he? Exactly the same. He'd been fasting for 40 days. Turn those stones into bread to gratify his flesh, if you like. And then he takes him up on a hill and he shows him, doesn't he, all of the kingdoms of the world. And says, you can have the lot if you just bow down and worship me the once. And then he takes him, doesn't he, to the pinnacle of the temple in front of everybody that was gathered there for the feast. And he says, just jump off and the angels will catch you. And just imagine that, being caught by the angels. Everybody would be looking as you come screaming down through the sky. But then the angels will come and gather you up so that your feet will not hit the rocks. And you will be standing there
and everybody will be ready, willing to listen to anything you have to say. It's always the same, isn't it? The lusts of the flesh, the lusts of the world, and the pride of life, John tells us. And we need to know not only God and not only the work of the devil, but we need to know ourselves. We need to get to know ourselves. Because the devil is going to come against each and every one of us if we're believers. And the devil is going to do the best job he possibly can on each and every one of us. He roams around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he can devour. And if all the things of the world mean nothing to you, and if pride and reputation and ego and what other people think of you mean nothing to you, and you couldn't give two hoots what anybody else thought about you, he's going to get you by the flesh, isn't he? He's going to make drinking and drugs and sexual immorality and greediness and all manner of other things, he's going to get you that way. He's going to try and get you in one of those three ways. Sometimes some poor people, they struggle with all three. But nobody escapes all three. Every last one of us will have a weakness somewhere. Samson had a weakness. And every last one of us, every other person in the Bible apart from Jesus, you can see them in some way has a weakness. Sometimes it's the flesh, women, drunkenness, gluttony, greediness, and those kinds of things. Sometimes it's money and possessions and worldliness. Other times they couldn't care about those two, but they just love a pat on the back. They love it when people say how good you are and what you have done. The devil's going to get you. He's going to get you unless you know yourself, unless you get to know your own weaknesses, unless you find things in the Bible to arm you against these things, and you work to resist them with all of your might. Samson, well, the writing's on the wall, so to speak. The alarms are ringing already, aren't they, before he's even married. But it goes on and it gets worse. And we very clearly see man's weakness in the area in Samson's life here. Well, we've seen the providence of God, we've seen the power of God, we've seen the weakness of man. But the last thing we want to see this evening as we come to an end is that we shouldn't despise the days of small things. Although he has his weakness here and he caves in, doesn't he, to this Philistine wife, he caves in to Delilah, he caves in to a number of other women and really makes a bit of a mess of things because of the weakness of his flesh later on, we shall see. But the last thing we see in verse 19 and 20, then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily. He owes 30 garments, doesn't he? He's got to pay off the bet, or goodness knows what's going to happen, and his word is his word. And so he's got to get 30 garments from somewhere, large sum of money. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon, and he killed 30 of their men, took their apparel, and gave the changes of clothing to those who had explained the riddle. So his anger was aroused, and he went back to his father's house, we are told. Well, everybody, I'm sure, in Ashkelon is just suddenly ringing 999 in a panic. Here comes Samson, and Samson's come to kill 30 men and take their clothing. You can almost imagine the scene. Everybody is running backwards and forwards, and if they had mobile phones and 999, they'd all be ringing it. Samson kills, strips 30 men so that he can pay off his bet, and then he storms back in anger. This is not the anger of Samson, though, but this is the work of God, isn't it? You see, God is going to deliver them from the tyranny and the oppression of the Philistines. And although Samson is real angry in the situation, what is really going on is what was told us in chapter 13, that he is beginning to judge Israel and deliver them from the enemy. Now, you might say 30 men, well, what is that in light of a nation? True, and admittedly,
It's not very much, is it? Considering this man can rip a lion in part, considering this man, well, is going to later on kill 1,000 men, you think, what is dealing with 30 men really in light of an entire nation? And these people are just from some village in the middle of nowhere. Why doesn't he go to the capital city and just wreak havoc in the capital city? Well, it reminds us that often when God is at work, he starts with small things. We're told never to despise the days of small things. And as long as God is working, as long as we are looking to God, to him to work through us, we shouldn't despise the days of small things. If our hearts are right, and if we're seeking the Lord, and if we're committing our time, talents, and our resources and our lives to him, does it matter if it is only a small thing? We would all, I'm sure, many of us here this evening would love to do great and mighty things for God. But as long as our hearts are right and our time and our lives are submitted to him and he only gives us a small thing to do, isn't that enough? Isn't it enough that we would just commit our lives to him and he would take them up and do his pleasure and his will with them? We don't need to worry about the big things. We don't need to worry about the masses who don't know the Lord in many ways. If we are serving, if we are walking in the Spirit, if we are committed, we shouldn't despise the days of small things. So we must have a biblically informed understanding of the sovereignty and the providence of God, as we see that at the beginning. We need to seek and experience God's power in our lives to enable us to be like Jesus in many ways. We need to come to recognize and understand our own weaknesses and overcome them, like Samson just didn't seem to throughout his life in a number of ways. And we need not despise the days of small things, as long as the Lord is working through us, if our faith is genuine and sincere. Well, we'll carry on in our narrative as we will carry on in chapter 15 and next week in the book of Judges. But, I always study and I always get things down on paper, and I'll always wait until God has said something to me. And I kind of think, well, if God has said a number of things to me, I'm pretty sure he can say a number of things to you. And I think that passage is just as relevant, just as applicable, just as living and practical to us today as it ever has or ever will be. Well, we're going to finish this.